From the boardroom to the shop floor, good business runs on good governance. Join esteemed expert in governance, Dr. Nimrod Mbele, for the next hour as he takes us beyond governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa.
Hello everyone and welcome to tonight's installment of Beyond Governance here at 101.9 High FM. My name is Nimrod Mbele. I'm delighted once again to be sharing this space and time with you on this glorious Wednesday in Johannesburg as we continue to interrogate ideas, policies and leadership choices shaping our nation's future. On this platform, we go beyond the surface, we unpack the substance behind the stories, challenge the uncomfortable narratives and confront the truth for what it is. We shine light on gaps that exist in policy discourse. We look at contradictions and we also identify our blind spots. Our aim is pretty much clear. We drive accountability, inform debates, and we are deliberate on what the reforms should be looking at. In tonight's conversation, we extend this particular line of thought by putting spotlight on governance lapses in the country. We all know that over the past 5 years or so, actually more than 5 years, South Africa has witnessed troubling stories of breakdowns and across the public institutions, from corruption syndicates in Dambisa Hospital that made headlines and which led to the assassination of the whistleblower Babita Deokaran. The municipal mafia, water mafia, we know about it, which is obviously a network which cripples service delivery. We've also learned recently about the infiltration of law enforcement structures that has been termed blue capture, large-scale procurement scandals back in Transnet during the COVID-19, and a whole lot of other allegations now recently at the Independent Development Trust, which led to the resignation or the suspension of the CEO. These cases reveal a very disturbing pattern, which in my view looks at the weak ethical controls. We look at compromised procurement systems. We look at inadequate oversight. We look at leadership failure at highest level. Beyond the financial losses, or yes, there are big financial losses to the public purse, these issues expose deep systemic vulnerabilities in the governance frameworks meant to safeguard accountability and service delivery, which has become such a big issue in this country. As we reflect on this development, the central question is not only how these lapses occurred, but what lessons they offer for reform, particularly in strengthening ethical leadership, which is also underpinned by meritocracy in those key positions, and how do you protect the whistleblowers, and how do we enforce the role of the board oversight and rebuilding the public trust in institutions tasked with serving the citizen. In making sense of this very complex and multi-layered issue around governance lapses institutions that have been entrusted to deliver services, I'm joined by Abrigi Thabo Motaung to help us unpack and what these governance lapses means for accountability and reform in South Africa. Without any waste of time, let me take this opportunity to welcome Advocate Legamoren.
Good evening, sir, and good evening to your listeners. Thank you very much for the invitation.
You're most welcome, sir. When you look back, when you take a step back and examine the patterns of governance lapses over the past years, across health, municipalities, law enforcement, and state-owned entities, what is your overall assessment of South African governance trajectory?
I think it is deteriorated drastically, and simply because those institutions that are entrusted with the development or taking care of the general society in South Africa are now being used as a means to advance individuals' personal agendas, and to an extent that they try then and manipulate the processes from governance point of view. We have laws that has also enabled people who are entrusted with certain responsibilities to have a leeway. I'll give you an example. The Eskom MOI, Memorandum of Incorporation, says the board interviews the CEO candidates and they shortlist three, but it then gives the Minister of Energy a prerogative to choose which of the three. There is no process that informs that. Literally, the boss makes a decision on first, second, third name and recommends, and then a minister has a discretion. And what informs that discretion? What, you know, it's and if you look at the statutory obligation that is placed on the board, the fiduciary duty of the board, and that decision making process, there's a serious disjuncture. There's a serious disconnect between how the writing of the memorandum of incorporation and that. So it shows you that there's a power shift that is not legally rational. That is even logically, I mean, a group of people would sit, interview, interrogate, you know, check much information, but ultimately there are powers vested on an individual, which causes a disconnect. I was just exemplifying to say it has deteriorated simply because there's a passing. The role of shareholder representatives and those who are entrusted with the governance of institutions has been literally blurred. Shareholder representative, they've got some idea that the board reports to them, which is actually not the case. And this is how things have deteriorated to where they are today.
I couldn't agree with you more, especially on the perspective. That's the reason why we had National Enterprises Bill, which hasn't really been implemented because it is such huge. It was meant to rectify those challenges that you're putting forward, and suppose in the meantime it would have made a lot of sense if the minister in energy was himself a competent technical person who understands the operations. You know, you put a politician in highly technical environment without necessary or having prerequisite competence in the complexity of energy. That makes it even worse, because a minister could potentially make a decision, even though it shouldn't be the case, because the board is ultimately responsible and accountable to the minister. So you can't be accountable when you're not responsible for choosing the person that leads the entity. But I couldn't agree with you on that particular point. You know, perhaps maybe looking at other examples, we've seen how, you know, Tembisa Hospital was siphoned out, you know, by crooks, so to say. When you look at, you know, cases such as Tembisa, you know, around corruption and the syndicates, which led to the assassination of the whistleblower, Babita. And of course, when you also compound that with the likes of water mafia in municipalities, what does it say about oversight systems, and are they being deliberately undermined, or they simply do not have what it takes to provide effective guidance?
Again, you know, let's use the Tembisa example that you've alluded to, and without prejudging facts and all that, you know, there's a concept that is called correlation. There's a movement on one variable and there's a movement on another variable. At the time of the assassination of the person, of Babita, there are payments that are blocked. You see, so she she has created a hurdle or an impediment for a particular action to happen. It is disheartening that she then is assassinated, then the payments are released, to show exactly what was the problem. And at the time now, those monitoring institutions could have moved swiftly because you could see that which levers were moved and why those levers were moved. So there's a correlation, there's a sort of that relationship is linear. You can see the movement of the relationship. Now I'm saying it's the inaction that is inherent, or the the inability of people who are entrusted with the responsibilities not wanting to move swiftly. That matter does not require expertise. It just requires willingness to resolve it, because you could pick up to say, but these are beneficiary institutions. These are companies, these are persons who would have been affected by what this situation has, has resulted to be what it is. So all I'm simply saying is that it's not that they have been rendered, it is an unwillingness of persons who are entrusted with those responsibilities. And you know, the overall view is that because there's no intention, because there is no purpose that is pursued, this institution has been allowed to completely lapse, and not because of incompetence, simply because it's to the benefit of others, for those that are entrusted with that responsibility, not to do what they're supposed to do. And it's a deliberate act, a malicious act for personal enrichment of certain individuals.
On that note, let's take a quick break. We'll come back. When we come back, I want us to dig a little bit more on the culture of impunity that seems to be pervasive across most institutions.
This is Beyond Governance with Dr. Nimrod Mbele on 101.9 High FM.
It is now 21 minutes after 6 o'clock. If you've just joined us, I'm having a conversation with Advocate Mutaung. We are unpacking governance lapses across the country, from public health institutions, municipalities and law enforcement, as well as state enterprises. Before we took that break, Advocate here was giving us a wholesome approach in terms of what he perceives as glitches. The point that he made about the assassination of Babita was, I think he made a very important point that, you know, before her assassination, you know, a number of invoices were not paid, but immediately after assassination, those invoices were released, which obviously begs the question, or suggests that, you know, she was an impediment, probably on asking right questions. But be that as it may, one issue that the advocate raised, which I think is important, is that the structures are there, but people who are interested in managing those institutions simply are not willing to act. And it begs the big questions around accountability. It begs the question around impunity, because, you know, these issues, one would have assumed that what we have seen in the Zondo Commission and a whole lot of other commissioned people, that would have served as a deterrent. Clearly, what you've seen, people are no longer petrified, are no longer scared of anything. Why do you think the culture of impunity is so deep and so entrenched, even though these issues are coming out every other time?
There are two things. It does on a face value look like there is even reward. So I would be accused of embezzlement on organization A, and I will then be under the radar for an X period, and then I'll resurface elsewhere as something else. And there is no cross reference. It doesn't matter. That culture of impunity, where people don't just account, you know, it doesn't matter. And it does seem like we have created a norm where, with affliction of time, certain things disappear. So, you know, you've got to be under the radar for a certain period of time, and then whatever you are struggling with would then be, you know, it will either be normalized or be accepted that whatever it is, it has been handled, and it's no longer an issue, and it can disappear just like that. And that sort of, it's like a compensation to those who are in the wrong, and those who are in observance, they feel like, wow, this system is actually rewarding. So I could do wrongdoing, and in return, there could be something for me, because there are no consequences. There is nothing, and the that that culture of impunity has been so much entrenched, because we can literally name persons who were either been found wanting for wrongdoing and all that, and there has been absolute nothing after that. They've managed to continue with their life as if it's normal. So that is one observation of in society. And you know, when there's no fear, when the system is completely disregarded to be ineffective, especially that is established to prohibit unlawful conduct, it's been seen not to be effective. There is nothing that prohibits anybody from doing anything, because we all feel like we will escape, and that culture is deeply entrenched. You know, it's a norm. You sit in a recruitment interview and somebody would be bold enough to say, there's a word, you know, comrades prefer to use. They'll do something like, the mandate is on this one. You know? I mean, how do you even boldly say the mandate is on this one? How can we give mandate when we should be looking at competitive assessment? You know, it's yeah. This is our comrade. This comrade is proper. This guy is not going to be delivering, you know. And when people use the word like delivering, you're thinking of services or what the organization is to. Some they are referring to something else. So those are type of sort of traits that sort of embeds that culture, you know. They really root it, because you know that I'll get away with this.
But here's the thing, Advocate. You as a deployee in inverted commas to a particular institution, whether it's municipality or whether it's a state-owned enterprises, and you are so-called preferred candidate, to use your explanation, but does it not occur, or at what point should it occur to the incumbent that ultimately, from the governance point of view, whoever sits in that particular board in that particular institution needs to serve the organization first, and when decisions are made, that person has to ensure that the best interest of the organization prevail over the interest of anybody else, because you know, when you look at the judgment rule from a Companies Act point of view, wherein an individual were found or individuals at the board level, were seen not to have applied their minds diligently on a decision that has been taken. Those individuals, have seen that the former, SA chairperson, Dudu Mieni, may her soul rest in peace. You know, she was declared delinquent director, purely because, she ought to have known better. And you would imagine, you'd think those kinds of issues would enable an individual who sits in that particular position, say, no, oh, business, I can hear you. But this is what the laws say. You know, but ultimately the responsibility lies with the person who sits in that. It doesn't matter whether the minister pushed you or anybody pushed you, but you as an individual, where do we draw the line?
But your question premises on an assumption that says that person that has been put there has a know-how, has the skill, has the experience, and has the expertise, so that they're able to make that judgment call, because that will emanate from a judgment call, you know. But that comes from the challenge, the inherent, the systematic challenge is that you perpetually deploy or put people with no skill, who don't understand who this concept of governance is, and them, they're actually in two different worlds. I mean, you know, the person concerned that you've exemplified, may her soul rest in peace, did they have the necessary credentials or competence to even understand? And to an extent that, you know, do people even understand the implications of being declared a delinquent director and the ramifications thereof? So when you deal with these individuals and these systematic problems. The challenge is that if a young man is excited because he's been, you know, I always use this expedition, you've been expedited to get into a board prematurely. What you're consumed with is to appease your master. So there's a conflict of interest between what you've alluded to, which is the best interest of the company, or to appease the person who put me in this position, because for you, that position is elevation. That's why I'm saying we've got to go back to the skill set of persons required. We've got to find persons who have self-actualized, who have over time have done what they needed to do. You know, I always refer to Maslow hierarchy of needs to say, you've got to find a person who has mastered all these things. Now, if you take, I've watched public institutions where you look at the persons who've been appointed and you look at the skill set and you're thinking, do they have what it takes to run this institution? And I'm saying that's an inherent problem. That's where. So all the things you are saying, there's a dependency on the fact that do I have the credentials to act in the best interest of the institution? Unfortunately, if I was pushed, I would always want to sing for my supper, because for me, appeasing my master sort of guarantee me to have a longevity in an institution. I mean,
he who pays the piper pays the bills. You know,
when yes, I mean, you get institutions where they now appoint non-executive directors for 12 months. I mean, what a contradiction. I mean, when a board has to drive a strategy and they're appointed for a period of 12 months, I mean, that in itself, it's a collapse of governance. Yeah. You know, that in itself, it says, I mean, the general observation and the King Codes dictate a minimum period of at least 36 months. But you get public institutions where bodies are appointed for like 12 months. And yeah, you don't understand.
But is there an insight? I mean, because we have a depth of substance, depth of know-how in terms of curating policies. But we seems to be lacking when it comes to political will. Why are politicians have so much appreciation of disgrace or embarrassment?
Now, I'll exemplify it. I sat in a board of a municipal institution, and at some point the board took a decision and the mayor challenged the decision of the board. And the board was summoned into a meeting with the mayor. And the board was then coerced into some decision. And board members, I was part of that board, and I refused. I said, there is no place, even in the shareholder compact between the board and the shareholder representative, for us to make decisions together. So there can't be an agreement between the board and the mayor. There can't be a compromise. The challenge is that if individuals are not sufficiently competent to understand what corporate governance is, they then take these compromising positions, you know, where you are told, this is organizational direction. You know, there is no organizational direction. Mm. The interest of the organization, it's what needs to carry the most weight. Now, but I'm saying because the lines are blurred, because we're trying to appease, it goes back to that appeasing, what do we think are our masters? These are public institutions. Perhaps that's where it should start, to say no individual or persons are owning these public institutions. To an extent that you are there, you are not saving, again, you know, we even have a terms, you are saving the prerogative. I mean, there were two instances where boards and shareholder reps went to court, and the courts are clear. I mean, the precedent is clear that the board have a last say on any matter relating to an institution. You know, they are a final arbiter on any matter that relates to that institution.
I couldn't agree with you more. Perhaps maybe let's take back, because some of these issues are, they start with the basis for recruitment. You know, we can all argue that if your recruitment template is not based on meritocracy, that is, you don't recruit and employ people with skills and competencies and an appreciation of the complexities that they would be, you know, managing an organization. That's where the biggest problem starts, because if you were to employ men and women who are capable, who are able to act as agents, not just someone who take instruction, but someone who can say, look, by the way, this is not permissible by law. And are you aware that you're asking me to? Are you aware that you're asking me to break the law? So perhaps maybe if we were to have a very robust and independent recruitment and selection processes with external individuals such as yourself, we may have a chance of minimizing, the kind of malpractice that you see by the time an individual like the IDT CEO, making all lot of shenanigans. So perhaps maybe that should be a good starting point. And the other point that perhaps maybe I want you to reflect on, in countries such as China, for you to become a public representative, you have to be at your highest level. And it's a highly sought after position. And when you take, say, for an example, our metric, so top 10 of those that got about like 10 distinction and so on and so forth, those are the people who are qualified to become, public servants. And at what point are we in this country going to have a rigorous template that is non-negotiable for anybody to serve in that particular space? Not because of your political credentials, not how many stones you've thrown, not proximity to politicians that are known or known, but, it's about credentials, it's about your qualifications, it's about what has been your performance. I want us to take a break. When you come back on this, I want you to reflect on those critical issues that are put forward.
This is Beyond Governance with Dr. Nimrod Mbele on 101.9 High FM.
Welcome back. This is Beyond Governance. My name is Nimrod Mbele. I'm joined by Advocate Mutaung. We are unpacking very complex issues around governance lapses that we have noticed across the country when looking at public health institutions, municipality and law enforcement agencies now of late have been embroiled in all form of shenanigans that have really compromised and pretty much eroded the public trust, which is so desperately needed. Before we took that break, one of the issues that I put to advocate here is perhaps maybe the starting point in trying to rebuild trust and confidence in public institution is to look at the template which we use in bringing people at those particular positions. And because we have learned that in the past, and even still now, we have people who are appointed to senior positions purely because of their political allegiance, people who have proximity to certain politicians. And hence we hear stories like comrade this, comrade that, this comrade has got mandate. And perhaps maybe if we were to have a panel of interviews that is man or that is independent, because ultimately we need to provide assurance to the ordinary citizen that whoever that is going to be appointed will serve the country. What does it take for us to get that building block right?
Now, you see, the fundamentals here again have been dropped, and I'm going to explain. Now, there are two functions in government. There's policy formulation and strategy drive, and there's bureaucracy, a function of bureaucracy, which is, a policy drive says, this is what we need to achieve, this is what we've set, and now those that are entrusted with policy formulation and delivery drive are politicians, because they carry the electoral mandate. They've been put there through. Those who are entrusted with implementation are the bureaucrats. These are competent, learned individuals. Now, we blur that. We have a discussions where we allow those who are entrusted with policy formulation to to some extent to be operational. Part of the mess we are dealing with here, we've seen a politician dismantling an operational structure, which is not part of their mandate. It's not part of their competency at all. So all I'm saying is that if we are able to, and individuals entrusted with this, to say, I'm not going to be wanting to be in the good books of those who are entrusted with a different responsibility than mine, I will stand. And unfortunately, over time, we have compromised ourselves. We don't want to stand for a principle. We would rather be in favorable books of certain persons and compromise the core essence of why these functions have been given different responsibilities, because segregation of duty, it's meant to ensure that the sound governance, but we've blurred the lines and we've allowed wrongdoing and we've accepted it. People are bosses of things they're not supposed to be bossing. You know, bureaucrats are supposed to be functional administrators who are in charge of making those policies that have been formulated by politicians operational. So we've got to have that clear segregation of duty, and that would help cure those issues that we are referring to.
But Advocate, you know, those segregations on paper, they are there. Every policy is very clear on the roles and responsibilities based on the principle. When you look at the shareholder conflict that you've referred to in all the SOEs, those issues are there. It is just that we have allowed, especially the bureaucrats have allowed themselves to be manipulated by the politicians. Because one thing that I've picked up in my 20, 30 years of experience, engaging and seeing how public officials run like headless chickens when they are possessing the technical know-how of how to translate a policy into a program, track the implementation and report on it, that no, the minister said this, the minister, you know, I'm like, you know, yes, it's okay, the minister, you have to take a cue on what the minister said, but ultimately you as a bureaucrat, you have the technical capability and the acumen, you know, to correct what the minister may make a policy pronouncement. But some of these pronouncements, they go overboard to your point of meddling with operations. Surely that is still a responsibility of the bureaucrats, you know, to use agencies. But, well, we can't do that. To what point, what will it take? I know it's very complex because, you know, we're dealing with people who are looking after their own families. And nobody wants to be on the wrong side, because we know that it can, you know, they can make your life miserable if you are principled. But how do we create a culture in the same way that we've talked about whistleblower, which most people fear now that, you know, what's the point of raising a concern because, you know, Babita was killed. So everybody is afraid. This cancer, obviously, is growing immensely. At what point do you think we may have to arrest it, and what would it take to arrest it?
At the point, and this is very crucial, it's at the point where, you know, like I said, we sing for our supper. It's at the point where people stand for principle. Mm-hmm. And not the, you know, 1 year a minister dismantled the board of Transnet, and because the board members, actually, it was a Transnet, yes. Transnet or
it's Prasa, I think.
Prasa, yes. And at the time, Popo Molefe was the chairperson of the board. And they challenged the wrongful removal through the court. And they were reinstated. And that brought the minister to his knees, because suddenly there was a rude awakening to say, but You've got powers that you don't think you have, and it's not a lost cause. You know, I was saying to some people, we need to be grateful because at least we are a nation that has a conscience. The extent to which some of the things through the current commissions have been exposed are a path to some redemption walk, because suddenly at least one person was brave enough to say, but there's a bit of wrongdoing here. The fact that a minister could be held before a commission and be told to say, but you, Hang Ten, you don't have power. You are now operationalizing your function. That at least raises the level of consciousness and awareness. But I would say this, as long as we choose to not deal with real issues, rather opt to appease our masters at all costs, this is what has led to the demise of our public institutions. And we need to rectify that. But how do you rectify that? Don't put people in positions that they think it's elevation instead of contribution. You know, when I'm in a board and I think it's elevation, I'll always do wrong things because I don't have... Mm. But when I think it's... I am being trusted with public responsibility...
And huge responsibilities. You know, to see them board, it's a huge responsibility.
I will act correctly. I will tell the minister that that is not going to happen under my watch.
But here's another interesting point about, you know, how greed... has, I mean, for an example, when you look at the recent saga wherein the CEO of IDT was trying to solicit a bribe, you know, to a journalist, because that also says a lot about the greed. Here you are, gainfully employed, and for so whatever reason, you are embroiled in all manner of shenanigans, which means... In obvious, over and above the lacks of control and cult, again, going back to the culture of impunity, you would not have IDT CEO behaving in the manner if there was no precedent and if there was no corrective action that deterred anybody in that particular space. And again, I want to say, could the CEO be doing this in cahoots with other board members? Even though the board member said, no, not in our name. She was immediately suspended, which is the right thing to do. But it does beg the question, given the politicization of administration, and that really taints most boards, and which is very unfortunate. Your take on that?
Yeah, but again, board members need to understand. And the board orientation, it becomes critical. And but again, you know, and like, and I'll overemphasize this fact. For an example, in one, I know of a board where somebody who had never been in a management position was elevated into a board. Now, the basics are not there. And their understanding is that the politician is their boss. Their understanding is that I report to a politician, which collapses governance. But significantly is that we, at some point, a CEO told a board that, no, I don't report to you. I actually report to the MMC, you know? And he challenged... the board's discretion to suspend him, and he was saying, but this decision is not supposed to be the board decision, it's supposed to be the politician's decision. But I'm saying, up to a point where we also need, and politicians need to be educated, but the fact that you give a politician a veto power to appoint board members, I mean how
that's problematic. That is a recipe for a disaster.
Yes, how the entire CITES boards were dissolved after the questions were asked relating to persons who were appointed tells a story that these persons have a prerogative that and powers that are not even statutory based, that you don't know where they accept this power that they suddenly have and they use. These are practical situations that we need to say. The function of bureaucrats is to say, you are a bureaucrat, for example, you put 3-5 DGs together, and their function, because they're bureaucrats, is to, one, vet these persons, to look at their competency skills. But we've got institutions in South Africa, i.e. your Institute of Directors. You need to say, these are people that have applied, that have been shortlisted. Please help us to do competency assessment on them and make recommendations to say this can be board members. You give us a list, we'll then tune it down. But it shouldn't be that they advertise, they recruit, and they also host AGMs, and you know, and now there's, and we need to rectify. We need to go back retrospectively. If you were to ask me, well, how do you start with resolving this
question? On that note, in fact, that is a point that I wanted to reflect. Let's take a quick break. We'll be back. When you come back, I want to start from the very point that you've just mentioned.
This is Beyond Governance with Dr. Nimrod Mbele on 101.9 High FM.
Welcome back. If you've just joined us, we're literally 8 minutes before we close our very interesting conversation. I'm joined by Advocate Mutau. We're unpacking governance lapses across the country. We're looking at public institutions, municipalities, and now of late, law enforcement, as well as state entities. We all know that these institutions have been bedeviled with malfeasance. And before we took that break, an advocate, you were about to give us a practical ways in which these matters can be resolved. I mean, you reflect a little bit more on the recruitment, and that whoever that gets appointed in whatever position, they have to go through assessment test, and you know, based on assessment test, then the decision can be used to inform who is better positioned to what position, and sort of take us through that in practical terms.
So what I'm saying that we've got to guarantee one thing: the independence of boards. Mm. Boards should be independent. They should, for us to achieve what you spoke about earlier, the best interest of companies. You've got to get an independent board whose intention is clear: is to ensure that this thing is the sound governance. It's there's transparency. They follow the governance. We had a public institutions which is entrusted with our livelihood, not reporting for its financials for a period of more than two years, and guess who would always appear and justify the causes of why they are not reporting? It will be a minister, which you then say, but this guy should actually be irritated with the fact that the financials are not coming through. But he would come out and say there are problems. What? We are solving the problems. How are you solving the problems? You're not even entrusted to be doing that. Now, what I'm saying is that the board needs to be independent. And how you guarantee their independence is through an independent process where you put them through the minimum qualifications. King's Code of Corporate Governance, they give minimum skill set requirement. For example, a board obviously needs to have a skill mix that would enable them to be efficient. Now, what do I bring to the table as a board member? That's crucial. Whether I bring financial expertise, whether I bring technical expertise, so that you are then able to complement each other. But these are skill sets that we need. There's a skills metric that needs to be developed, particularly for boards, because they need to provide. Now, you've got to have that skill metrics and say, this person's, I'll use, for example, SAA. How do you compose the board of SAA? If I don't have aviation skills, there cannot be 10 of us or 9 of us in the
accountants
board.
Accountants and lawyers.
Who know nothing about aviation, and now we've got to take technical decisions. I mean, CEOs would manipulate you because they even speak the language you don't even understand, you know? So you've got to look at those things. But again, I'm saying we've got a policy framework that has created some deficiencies. I made an example earlier when we started this conversation with the Eskom Memorandum of Incorporation. You've got a clause in that Memorandum of Incorporation which, in all fairness, violate every piece of legislation, which says the minister has a... So the board would say we prefer candidate number 1, 2, and 3, and minister can go for number 3. But that CEO coming on board already from day one, he knows you didn't appoint me. Mm. I was appointed by a minister. So you are lame dogs that are sitting here trying to bug at me, but I know who's my master. So that's why I'm saying it's very, very important that we look at even policy framework and look at how best, because that's where you've got to try to change things and clean the system, because we've got to cure. You can't have a collapse of system, guys. It's heartbreaking that some 6-7 years ago, Transnet employed about 125,000 people, and today it's employing 15,000 people. It's you are collapsing public institutions that should be carrying the dreams and aspirations of the nation. And it's we've got to be intentional about curing them and fight inactiveness, because decision making is hard.
Well,
decisions are just not being made.
Absolutely. Look, unfortunately, you've run out of time. You're going to have to leave it here. Advocate, thank you so much for coming through. It's been absolutely beautiful to hear your thoughts, your insights on a very complex matter. You and I need to have a follow-up because there are a whole lot of issues that the listener certainly benefited. And we obviously have these kind of conversations so that we enlighten each other and so that we're able to confront the narrative and the truth for what it is. Thank you so much for coming through.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, and much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you so much. There we go. That was Advocate Mutaung, giving us a very interesting insight. Advocate, once again, thank you for your insight and candor. What tonight's discussion makes clear is that governance failures are never just about numbers on the balance sheet. They are about the lives disrupted. They are about communities deprived and the trust that is broken, from hospitals to municipalities, from state-owned enterprises to law enforcement. The pattern is unmistakable. Where the ethical leadership is weak, accountability is definitely compromised, and the public suffers. But there are also powerful lessons in all this. Institutions do not collapse overnight. They erode when oversight is ignored, when boards look away, when whistleblowers are silenced, and leadership forgets its duty to serve. The reforms that we speak about are not abstract or policy debate. They are difference between a state that works for the people and one that works against them. So in South Africa, the role of South Africa is to safeguard public purse and restore confidence in its institution by ensuring that ethical leadership is there. Without any waste of time, thank you so much for tuning in. It has been absolutely beautiful. I certainly think you have benefited in the same way that I did. Have yourself a wonderful evening. Shalom.